Here down here in the basement. Let's see. For starters, I got involved in this work the hard way. Shake any family tree, and surely a nut will fall. That's all I'm going to say on the live stream at the moment. But please come up to me afterwards, and we can talk more. I am currently working at a organization that just rebranded themselves Vibrant. We used to be the Mental Health Organization of New York City. We're an umbrella nonprofit that works on the National Suicide Lifeline, as well as NYC Well. Any New Yorkers might have seen some of the billboards. It's a crisis line. I do software architecture and application development there, some infrastructure security. Before that, I worked at Columbia University, and the job came with free tuition, so I was chipping away for ever on a PhD. I got my PhD in communications, but I'm going to tell the story of where and how I pivoted to end up working on the psychiatric pharmaceutical complex and a lot of the topics that we're going to be covering today. It is also my sixth hope, which is crazy to contemplate. I'm not 100% positive I hit all six in this past decade, but I was trying to figure out which one was which. But I've been doing this for a while, I think. And this is the first time I'm telling this story formally from the podium. So fragments of it have kind of slipped out, but I'm going to take a major leap today and come out around some of the actions and that I've been personally involved in. So here's where we're going today. I'm a lot more comfortable with an interactive format, so if folks kind of want to intercede, I'm not going to be able to see you, but poke up with any questions, and I'll try to save enough time to converse at the end. This first part of the story takes us back about 12 years to 2006, but really serves to foreshadow a lot of what's to come. I basically get the sense that most people in the room probably have a vague understanding of ways in which we're all overdiagnosed and over-medicated, but this campaign really highlights just how egregious the situation has become in the last decade and decade and a half. So this story starts out with a doctor, a lawyer, and a journalist walking into a bar. There was actually a class action suit against Eli Lilly. Back in 2006, the suit was about obesity, and it turned up in discovery that the documents implicated Lilly in knowingly downplaying the side effects of Zyprexa, which was their blockbuster, multi-billion dollar antipsychotic. excuse me. They were covering up the fact that they knew that this drug caused diabetes, and they also were pushing the drug off-label, which I'll explain in a moment, to kids and seniors and stuff. So yeah, this is the sense I think that most people have of kind of where we are today, but it's actually gotten a whole lot worse. And so the internal memos in this class action suit were really glaring and egregious. Basically, what off-label means is that, you know, doctors can prescribe drugs for anything, but pharmaceutical companies are only allowed to market them for conditions for which they've been approved. And these documents like demonstrated that Lilly had created personas of kids and seniors to push this stuff. I guess in the past decade, people probably, again, like I've said, have this understanding of how much things have gotten worse. Even the author of DSM-5 has come out talking about, of DSM-4 has come out critiquing DSM-5 for being overexpansive. But if you've been paying closer attention, you might have learned that what's happening with the kids especially, as well as seniors, veterans, and prisoners is really horrifying. You know, pediatric bipolar, which is a disease that was effectively created in the late 90s. The diagnoses are up, you know, 4,000% in the period I described there. And there are incidences of children as young as 2 and 3. This is Rebecca Riley and Destiny Hager, who were diagnosed at 2.5 with bipolar. Sometimes they were happy, sometimes they were sad. Some of these drugs cause like female breast growth in young boys who need to have mastectomies, you know, after them. So you really got to pay close attention to the details here to understand just, you know, what it is that that we're all up against. I'd say it's really important to also keep in mind, like, you know, the moment in history. So 2006 is after the Diebold memos were released, and, you know, synchronously WikiLeaks was officially founded in October of 2006, but they were not widely known or available. So part of what, you know, happened next was under the circumstances where people were trying really hard to figure out how to safely and anonymously leak hundreds of megabytes of documents, you know, to the web. So what happened in this case was that there was an expert witness for the plaintiff, and he read all these documents. He went to the Times. The Times said, this is amazing, but it's all under seal. We can't really run with it. But there's this lawyer in Alaska who does a lot of psych rights work, and this lawyer subpoenas the documents, you know, out from under seal, and immediately turns around and distributes them to the Times, NPR, and a bunch of activist organizations. So the Times actually in 2006 ran with, you know, three front page headlines, you know, describing exactly what I laid out. It didn't end up on Jon Stewart or O'Reilly, so few people remember it, but it's there for the record. There were a bunch of activists at the time determined to try to get the documents, the original documents, you know, also available to second tier investigative journalists, because beyond just the headlines, there was a lot of information in there that needed to be poured over. This was a period, if people recall, where citizen journalism was on the rise, and people were debating whether or not we needed journalists, and this was, you know, a very clear example of where and how, you know, journalists on the beat were remained incredibly valuable. You know, the occurrence of just the name of a Lilly scientist corresponding, say, not theoretically, with a Harvard researcher is only significant if you're on the beat and you know the people's names by names and stuff. So what happened was, at the time, some mythical Netroots helped get these documents online, and a group of activists, you know, started examining them and analyzing them. We at the time were using a gratis wiki platform called PPWiki, and everybody in the project was editing the wiki behind Tor. So, you know, it's a pretty early case of using Tor for social justice, and basically, Lilly's lawyers were very unhappy and tried initially to take down all of PPWiki, which was thousands of websites. And thankfully, the CEO of PPWiki was an old indie media activist who turned around and asked us if, you know, we wanted to actually fight this. And so the EFF stepped up, and this was their first wiki case. This was, like I said, in 2006. The group that was analyzing these documents were all using the tag or the moniker Zyprexa Kills, anticipating that if stuff had gotten taken down, we'd still be able to search for it or find each other. And it turned into like a classic, you know, First Amendment prior restraint, you know, situation where basically in this country, at least nominally, folks are allowed to say anything and potentially get punished for it afterwards. But there's you know, a lot of case law that tries to protect, you know, that kind of speech in the first place. And Fred von Lohmann at the EFF actually made an argument that was arguably somewhat unique to wikis, where to, you know, basically try to censor or shut down a publicly editable wiki would be to shut up the entire world, so to speak. So there's a lot of interesting detail that, you know, kind of came through that, and I'll mention that, you know, basically I was the John Doe in this action, and 4 months on a class action suit in federal district court is, you know, incredibly harrowing and stressful for anyone involved. Like, anything can happen in open court, and you know, contempt could lead to jail time or penalties, and it's you know, anyone going through that definitely needs a lot of support. it's worth talking about, you know, some of the fallout, or, you know, what happened there in terms of, you know, the ruling was like this 80-page ruling, and the judge was certainly unhappy that his documents were taken out from under seal. They were allowed to remain open, which was significant. There were a bunch of attorney generals and congressional oversight committees that we had evidence were downloading these documents. And as we'll see, like, a documentary that just came out last year featured these documents basically as a main character in the documentary. So there's a lot of good reasons to keep trying to liberate these kinds of documents, and they do matter over time. They still matter in court, and they still matter for journalists and researchers over time, and we'll get to that. But in any case, the internet won, but not because of citizen journalism or because of public health concerns, basically because, you know, the horse was out of the barn kind of thing. So that was like what led me to this field. At the time, I was pretty interested in surveillance and transparency and privacy issues. And, you know, when I got embroiled in this story, it really opened my eyes to what was going on in this beat. And a huge concern at the time was that most of the folks talking about corruption in psychiatry and pharma were either Scientologists or charlatans. And the prospect of trying to do some work in this area that was, you know, credible and had the backing of the Columbia School of Journalism was really, really alluring to me. Here are some other fallouts and implications of some of the off-label marketing that was, you know, really apparent in those memos. Those are fines that each of these drug companies has been assessed, you know, over their off-label marketing of the drugs listed there. So obviously this is not just Lilly that's playing this game. Arguably this is like the cost of doing business, you know, for a lot of these companies. Note that a lot of those are B's for billion, and nonetheless that's still, you know, just a drop in the bucket. I think just closing this topic, you know, with regards to the antipsychotics is probably worth considering how in the late 90s the ADHD drugs were coming out of patent. If people know about, you know, how the pharmaceutical industry works, there's usually a pipeline, you know, that's fed by a blockbuster, and eventually the drugs come out of patent and they need replacements to kind of bolster or, you know, shore up the profits that they then lost. And as the ADHD drugs were coming out of patent, you know, there was a frantic moment as they looked about for what they had on hand. And there were these antipsychotics that, you know, seemed like they, you know, were very promising, but there just weren't enough schizophrenics to treat. And we saw at the time an expansive net of diagnosis that was widening as these drugs were then used to treat bipolar, to treat depression, and actually to treat eating disorders. They do cause insatiable hunger as well. In any case, the political economy, like, you know, as far as, you know, the intellectual property is concerned, is another topic, but also fascinating, you know, to consider. So that's kind of what got me into this topic. And in the course of working on it, I spent about 10 years doing an ethnography with radical mental health activists. And the next part of this presentation, where I talk about surveillance psychiatry, is not really on the tip of the tongues of most of the activists that I worked with, but is something that I've been observing, you know, working in the field, and that is also sort of the backdrop. And, you know, there's a lot of anecdotes and stories that hint at, you know, just some of what's happening here. Let's see. So, if you didn't think that, you know, drugging kids, seniors, vets, and prisoners with antipsychotics was bad enough, this other shoe has already dropped, and I'm going to explain to you now what's happening in case folks have not yet put it all together yet. And I've been, you know, presenting some of this material at like crypto parties and informally at different kind of meetups and stuff. And I found that this community especially kind of gets this problem the moment I put it out there, but not enough of us are thinking hard about this analysis and what to do about it. Big pharma's met big data. And And man, are they into each other. It's pharma was actually onto this before the data showed up. They were in the midst of shifting the paradigm to prevention before the data even showed up. So there's been a push and a move for the last like 15, 20 years towards what is sometimes called prodromal diagnosis, from the Greek, running ahead of, or sometimes called psychotic risk syndrome. You could think of it, I mean, it's also called early intervention. Even Hillary Clinton's mental health platform, was talking regularly about early intervention. And it's worth noting here that, you know, Western medicine is often critiqued for, you know, only being reactive and not being preventative enough. And it's worth thinking through exactly what prediction and prevention looks like, and its benign as well as sinister manifestations. So a lot of what I'm most concerned about is, ways in which the, you know, systems of power will be given like tools to widen these diagnostic nets even bigger than they are at the moment. If you manifest symptoms, you're psychotic. If you haven't manifested them yet, you're prodromal. If we treat you and you don't come down with anything, that means the treatment was successful. And part of what's really scary is the regress. So a lot of the indicators that suggest that you might be coming down with something soon become part of the syndrome, and then the predictors recede, you know, from there. So there's, you know, obviously like helping folks and supporting folks, you know, can be crucial and important. And there are a lot of folks that are suffering out there, for sure. But at the same time, it's really, really important to understand the way these dynamics are actually playing out on the web today. And sometimes this is now being called digital phenotyping. There are actually computer science researchers who claim they can do a better job than clinicians at predicting depression based on your Instagram feed. Just the color and saturation alone, they claim, is enough to do a better job than clinicians, which I'm not sure what that says about clinicians or their computer science, but blue photos apparently indicate blueness. There's been a research study trying to predict manic episodes based on Facebook posts. Again, not even the content of the posts, just the frequency and the status. Thomas Insel, who was the head of the NIMH, left the NIMH for Google for their data and machine learning, and he was the one who's coined the phrase digital phenotyping. Google's life sciences was not moving fast enough, and he's actually created a startup to do just this, to do this predictive and preventative, like diagnosis and interventions. I've learned at Vibrant that this entire paradigm of algorithmic diagnosis is going to be sold to all of us, or they will attempt to sell this to all of us, under the umbrella of suicide prevention. Like, who doesn't want to stop suicide? But I imagine that a lot of folks in this audience will recognize how this infrastructure will also be used to detect all forms of deviance, dissent, and protest. It's a grave concern, and I actually see this daily. There's folks that are voraciously interested in our data. To some degrees, our incompetence benefits us all because we don't necessarily always have it, but there are a lot of groups out there who do. We actually are in conversation with people like Facebook and Google and Twitter and those companies themselves, and they are trying to improve some of the ways that they react to crisis on their platforms, but it's very crude. I was working really closely with mad activists, and you know, there's a story about how there was a support group that was meeting in Facebook. Admittedly, they probably shouldn't have been there. They hadn't been there, but that's where everyone was. And there was a time, and it's changed a bit, but it's still pretty much like this, where Facebook encourages users to, you know, effectively rat out or indicate if somebody's in trouble. And admittedly, it's a very complicated problem, and they're trying to do better in terms of you know, having, you know, counselors on the other end and maybe directing people to talk to folks. But at the time, it was really just a matter of reporting somebody as suicidal, or just like you report something as spam. And then basically, you know, the cops could show up at your door. And so this happened to somebody in one of the support groups, and they went back to the support group and, you know, asked if anyone had, you know, ratted them out to Facebook, and everyone denied it and said it must have been another support group. But the outcome was is that that support group on Facebook decided to preemptively start deleting any message that could be construed as self-harm. So, you know, whatever the intent was of this support mechanism completely backfired, because it meant that people were no longer in a place where they could feel safe sharing or expressing, you know, what was on their minds, which arguably is one of the few things that can help folks that are going through crisis like that. So so there's a lot of problems on these platforms, and they're getting worse. So in the wake of the election, Zuckerberg proudly, you know, composed this statement where he announced like all the positive uses of AI and is starting to talk about proactive detection on Facebook. We have no idea, you know, what the algorithm looks like or what they're looking for or what the consequences will be. Again, it is already the case that depending on what you say on Facebook, like the cops may be dispatched to your door. They do have a suicidal flow. And once again, there's not transparency around this. Zeynep Tufekci, whose name I'm sure I'm pronouncing wrong, is an academic down in North Carolina who has been talking a little bit about surveillance psychiatry as well. The running example she uses is, you know, pushing ads for casinos in Vegas on hypomanic users. And she points out that without, you know, any targeted intent, it is most likely that the machine learning algorithms are going to notice that certain populations respond to different ads better than others, and that we may inadvertently be building, you know, this system that is targeting folks. It's now's the time to really point out that, you know, Facebook, there was a leak, another leak, last year in Australia that indicated how Facebook is packaging and selling psychological vulnerability. So they figured out that a certain category of their users may be self-conscious about their weight and their eating, and there's certain days of the week that they're like a little more down about this than others, maybe Mondays, and they've packaged that up and let advertisers target, you know, like weight loss clothing and pills to that population. And so we know that much. And so I have tried to raise the flag at work about what it means to be running crisis support on Facebook as to whether or not any of those messages will feed that advertising beast. But again, that's kind of the tip of the iceberg on this stuff. There are, you know, regular stories about what reminds me of the baseline test in Blade Runner, of course, you know, where we're trying to, like, you know, predict, you know, what people's emotional state is. And I'm not sure why, you know. Well, yeah, the one comp, thank you. And the 2049 one had like one that was even closer to that. There's actually in psychology an emotional Stroop test that comes close to trying to like predict your baseline. But for some reason, like, this is a domain where there seems to be some confidence that we can do this kind of prediction. And somebody just published a paper this year, certain that, you know, from the neurology and the fMRIs, they could determine, you know, who was suicidal and who wasn't. And gotta throw this one in. People may have been tracking this from some years back. The pill that reports to your cell phone whether or not you've taken it or not. And unsurprisingly, especially to some of us doing this work, the first pill approved, you know, to use this technology was an antipsychotic. So Abilify is now able to tell your cell phone and then in turn your doctor whether or not you've taken the pill. And Stephen Colbert has a wonderful piece. We don't have time for that video today. But yeah, nothing is more reassuring to a schizophrenic than a corporation inserting sensors into your body and beaming that information to people watching your every move. This is here. This was approved in November. And then this is a little sci-fi, but barely. You know, it's really easy for me to imagine a computer scientist flailing about for a handy ontology that describes all of human behavior and what will be there, you know, with funding attached, but the DSM. So you've got all these video streams, you've got casinos in every city that's run the Olympics, you know, frantically trying to categorize like the behavior, you know, based on the video stream so that they don't have to hire people to watch them. And you know, it's going to be easy because the DSM is formulated in behavioristic terms to diagnose folks. And I'm pretty sure I know who's going to be diagnosed first, and it's going to be, you know, students and prisoners. Or, you know, think about the underprivileged that will be subjected to these forms of algorithmic diagnosis, and who on earth would manage to evade, you know, their gaze. So that's the problem. I do want to offer you some hope, and I do want to make sure we have time for discussion to kind of think through how to approach this. There are people who have been thinking about these problems and working on them, you know, not just the surveillance psychiatry, but the problem of psychiatry and the problem of normal. There is a mad resistance, and it's really important to differentiate here between the earlier waves of this, anti-psychiatry of the 70s. People may have run into folks like Thomas Szasz or R.D. Lang, you know, denying that mental illness exists. There's actually a new wave of psychiatric resistance, and a lot of my dissertation was about trying to describe what's going on in the movement today as folks try to nuance the politics and recognize and acknowledge suffering and not take more of an ableist, like, defiant stance that denies that and really is all about demanding a voice and narrating your own identity, telling your own story, and really being at the table when it comes to understanding, you know, your own experience and what it means to be normal. I think in many respects there's nothing more bizarre in some ways than to consider how, you know, it's a really small room of mostly white cisgendered men with degrees in Western medicine who are determining what a normal range of human experience is right now. And, you know, there's no social workers, psychologists, humanists, philosophers, social scientists, never mind patients or activists or their families, who are in the room writing the DSM and deciding what normal is and isn't. And, you know, as we contemplate, you know, where and how those systems are being embodied and ossified in code, it's really important that we all figure out how to involve ourselves in those conversations before they're etched in stone or silicon. So the new wave of the movement has, you know, taken up this mantra of the disability rights movement, nothing about us without us. It's like I was explaining, less about whether or not mental illness exists and more about, like, who's at the table describing what, you know, the treatment might look like. There's a wonderful art project out of the UK, the Designer Asylum, where this artist has invited a bunch of folks into a room and done all these seminars, asking them what they think, you know, their dream asylum might look like, you know, acknowledging that, you know, folks might need, you know, support or respite at times, but in trying to involve them in, like, forming and shaping what that might look like. And, you know, the creations are at times fanciful, at times, like, you know, Dali-esque or Seuss-esque, but at other times, like, really down to earth in terms of things that are missing from respite today. So the roots of, you know, this new wave of the movement, I think it's easy to point to ACT UP, which really, you know, set in motion this trope of patient empowerment, where patients, like, demanded an involvement in participation in determining their own treatment. Arguably, ACT UP, you know, they were interested in more attention from the pharmaceutical industry rather than less, but there's still something really important there. And like I said, the disability rights movement. And this is on. This is just a list of some of the organizations that I would point to that have cropped up in the last, like, 15, 20 years, or really bolstered themselves in the last 15, 20 years, you know, taking up this message of the primacy of voice and the privacy of, like, the primacy of the individuals, like, who are involved in, you know, these experiences, having a voice in narrating, again, their own meaning and finding their own meaning in the experience and using their own language to do so. One of the primary groups that I worked with and studied is called the Icarus Project. Just to give you a flavor of some of the stuff that they're about, I'm gonna play a little, see if this starts up.
I don't see myself as a person who is carrying around my madness.
Saying that it is nothing but a biological brain disorder lets everybody off the hook, you know, and then you don't have to look at oppression and you don't have to look at poverty and injustice and abuse and trauma, and makes it this situation where it's just the individual versus his or her inevitable biological madness.
There's this fundamental impulse either towards suppressing our traumas by medicating the symptoms of them away, or facing down our traumas, quote unquote, by delving straight into the teeth of whatever our childhood beasts are.
I think that a lot of people who get labeled as mentally ill in our society have really broken hearts.
If I was determined to live my life in a city and to work a really intensive, steady job in an office, I think I would have to take medication to do that. But I don't think that fact means that I have a disease. I think it means that it would take a pharmaceutical substance to override my instincts, to make me capable of fitting into a system that was not designed for someone with a spirit like mine.
We need to stop saying, you are crazy, stop being crazy. We need to stop putting all the focus and treatment on how can we make you stop being the person you are.
When you open up your radio transmitters and you are taking in all this information about the world, it ain't all good. When I open up in that way, I don't just see beauty and light and God and grass and, you know, I see suffering and bodies rotting in the streets and oppression and injustice, and a lot of pain and terror and fear also comes in.
Part of
So that keeps going on. That's an excerpt from Crooked Beauty, which is a 30-minute documentary that tells the story of one of the co-founders of the Icarus Project and the founding of Icarus as well. It's available, I think, on Vimeo and also Crooked Beauty, crookedbeauty.com, if anyone wants to check it out. So I was hoping that would give you just sort of a flavor of the language and the aesthetic that's used like within this project. And it's important because this project, you know, existed across, it bloomed in a very unique moment in internet history. It's looking like, you know, when there was an incredible amount of experimentation and exuberance and a lot of you know, DIY organizing at the time, and you know, the project took up, you know, multiple forms of media, from like, you know, web forums that, you know, at the time were running on free software, as well as, you know, independent zines. There's multiple publications that are like all available under Creative Commons licenses now, that tell, you know, a lot of the story and, you know, from this perspective, including, you know, things like the, you know, Getting Off of Psychiatric Drugs, you know, Harm Reduction Guide, which contains information in there that the, you know, the equivalent of, you know, the FDA in the UK makes widely available to the public, but here is really, really hard to come by, you know, especially like how coming off of, you know, psych drugs can cause all kinds of withdrawal effects that often look a lot like the crazy. But it's a harm reduction guide that acknowledges that some people might want to make this choice and some people might not. You know, crucial to the project has been an understanding that it accepts folks who take drugs and those who don't. It accepts people who use labels and those who don't. And it's, you know, kind of occupied this radical middle, I guess you could say, where it's trying to embrace like a real diversity of perspectives, and not you know, exclude, you know, anyone for choosing to find solace or meaning in any one way of thinking, you know, about their experiences or conditions or altered states. So that's a bit about the Icarus Project, which in many ways is exemplary of the leading edge of the movement I've been describing, namely this new wave of resistance to psychiatry, I'm currently involved in a project called the Institute for the Development of Human Arts, and we're doing a lot of teaching in the city, a lot of workshops in the city. People should check in with me if they're curious about that. Oh, I do have another slide here about, you know, some adjectives and different ways of talking about, you know, similar conditions. You know, on the left you'll see, you know, more judgmental or pejorative ways of describing, you know, children's behavior, and on the right, like, different kinds of language you could use. And, you know, the Icarus Project has always been about trying to develop a new language to talk about mental health, and we're really impoverished when it comes to language. And I'm hoping folks are making some of the connections here, or seeing the connections that I'm getting at, in terms of, you know, just how central language and labels and categories are to what we're embarking on as we build the systems that are categorizing behavior around us. So we can get to some of that in questions. I did want to give a shout out both to Rise Up and May 1st, you know, for decades they've been, you know, supporting projects like this, and, you know, protecting the privacy and anonymity of those involved in trying to take these kinds of actions. You know, some of them are open and public, but still incredibly sensitive and confidential, and others are edgier. So what I've laid out here at some level is a bit of a time bomb ticking at the moment. We should breathe. I think there are ways that we can approach this. I don't think that protocols and encryption are really going to address the heart of a lot of these issues here, though I do want to engage in some discussion in terms of, you know, what people are thinking about. I was at another session where somebody was saying that an important theme of this conference is sort of a what now, you know, just trying to bring things to people's attention and figure out how to alert them. Before coming back to ways to diffuse this time bomb of surveillance psychiatry, I do want to, like, just mention this little coda in terms of documents, and just an observation that I've made over the years is a lot of folks are excited about tools like Secure Drop and seem to wait around hoping for the right documents to show up. I think it's really important for us to hypothesize and postulate the documents we know are out there, and then, I didn't say you should solicit them, but you might know someone who has access to them. One never knows. So, you know, I'm pretty sure we would put good money that Monsanto has documents linking colony collapse disorder to, you know, Roundup, for example. We got to find those documents. You know, there was a Mozilla had an exhibit that was traveling around the country where they had the missing files, you know, kind of embodied. And not sure if you could read some of those, but in the case of pharma, I think it's become more and more clear to me that in the rampant epidemic of gun violence in this country, you know, prevailing mainstream media narrative, you know, tries to tie the problem to mental health instead of guns. But one really important missing interstitial step there is, like, which psych drugs were some of these shooters on? And not all of them were on psych drugs, but many probably were. And, you know, the antidepressants have had a black box warning on them for over a decade talking about suicidal ideation. It's only like 0.5 to 1% of the people who, you know, it occurs with, but they're giving it out like candy, so that adds up to big numbers. What the FDA hasn't acknowledged yet, although anecdotally, judicially, and journalistically, there's been, you know, ample evidence, is that the antidepressants also cause homicidal ideations. So demonstrating that, you know, scientifically would cost a fortune, but I'll bet you $1 billion that those studies have already been done. And in the late 80s and early 90s, I guarantee you, during the antidepressant trials, there were, you know, incidents of homicide that have been covered up. So if anybody can think of, you know, some handy documents that are, you know, protected by an Access database right now or something, indicating something like that, you'd be looking at a scandal bigger than, like, big tobacco's, you know, for an entire class of drugs and an industry. And then then it's just Russian roulette as to which drug goes down first, right, by brand name. So that was just a little coda on documents and what folks in this room can do. There's probably a lot more that people in this room can do, and I actually wanted to leave enough time for discussion around this because I think I put a lot out there, and I've got thoughts and ideas on, you know, approaches, but I'm curious to see, you know, where the room takes this. So does anybody want to jump in?
I just have a quick point of information. You had mentioned that the film Crooked Beauty is also available at crookedbeauty.com.
Yeah.
That turns out to be a blog for help with college essay writing. So I did a little quick searching, and a more useful website is Mad Dance Mental Health Film Trilogy.
You know, there's a trilogy now, so yeah. maybe the URL was abandoned. I apologize for that. Thank
no
worries, you.
For anybody I'll try interested, to put that it's, up. Mad Dance Mental Health Film Trilogy.com.
Mad Dance Mental Health. I am going to put these slides up also. Like, I'll post them on Twitter and, you know, wherever the conference, like, lets me do that. So thank you very much for that correction. Crooked Beauty, pretty unique, should be easy to find, but thank you for Mad Dance Trilogy. .org, was it?
MadDanceMentalHealthFilmTrilogy.com.
Okay. We'll get that. Excellent. Thank you.
So, you know, unfortunately, every time there's a mass shooting in this country, the first thing we're told is, now is not a good time to talk about this, right? And then the other thing we're told is, you know, we don't need to ban guns. We need to have more mental health services. So in keeping with what you're talking about, I'm just wondering, you know, are people who are, you know, maybe show signs of, you know, violence or mental illness or something, is there going to be a new, you know, jailing of people who haven't done anything yet, or putting them in psychiatric facilities, you know, just based on maybe what they, you know, blog or put on Facebook or Twitter, or, you know, I'm just wondering if there's anything that you're looking out in terms of things like that.
Yeah, thanks for the question. And the answer is most likely yes. There already have been incidents of people posting things on Twitter that have led, again, to law enforcement showing up at them. One thing I want to bring up, it was really clear to me when I went to a presentation with some folks from the UK that, you know, of course, you know, we suffer in this country from the lack of universal health care. And countries that have universal care get to have a conversation about the nature of care, whereas we're stuck on the binary of, like, do you have care or not? And one problem with being stuck in that binary is that it's really hard to tell people who are suffering that no care might be better than some of the care they're being offered. And you really want to be able to try to extend something to them. But yeah, the nature of care is really essential in what I'm trying to get at here. And I think a lot of folks are going to be targeted, although the funding keeps getting cut on any support services too. So that remains to be seen. Yeah.
So I want to say thank you for this presentation. It's a very important issue. It speaks to me personally, and I really wish that it did get more attention in general. That's really most of what I wanted to say. I did want to point out that anecdotally because I've had cause to look into these issues. There's abuse in our system, and the Soviet Union had the same thing. So I've been on both sides of it, market and not so market. And compulsion is a very insidious thing, and it's something that requires a lot more study and attention. I think it's a very important, very human issue. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. I more wanted to do a sort of speculative invitation for everyone in the room, sort of based on how you're talking about shifting language and nerdily reference the movies THX 1138, in which the workers are asked to self-diagnose themselves in their morning mirror every day and are required to take drugs, and they're heavily surveilled if they're not. And there's also an anime called Psychopaths, which is a play on psychopath, where it deals a lot with the similar, like, forced medication and trauma and stuff like that. But in these narratives, the outcomes are like individual escape from the system, or like the people involved are police officers or whatever, sort of, I don't know, and everything sort of stays within the system without language change. So I just want to sort of ask everyone to ask themselves how they're thinking about and what words they're using when they think about mental health and stuff like that. And I just wanted to double emphasize the importance of what you brought up with the
Thanks so much for those references. I'll mention real briefly that you know, when Occupy Wall Street broke out in the city, there was actually a call you know, to some of the groups I was working with to come down, because you know, even amongst those activists, there was no language other than the clinical mainstream to describe, you know, some of the deviant behavior that was emerging under like really extreme circumstances of police brutality, lack of sleep, poor nutrition. And so, you know, we just don't have the language to describe each other's behavior, like in ways that are not pathologizing.
Sure. Hi. I was wondering, do you think that we could kind of, I don't know, take a stab at the big data problem by maybe implementing something like the EU's GDPR?
To some extent. I mean, you know, clearly, like, you know, for some folks, you know, they may be able to hide their digital footprints better or exhaust better than others, but there's a lot of people that are interested in sharing and want to socialize. You know, and part of, I think, what the problem is here is that ways in which folks are being categorized, and I think that, you know, the records that are the basis for that categorization are going to be created, you know, is really what needs to be taken up politically. So I think that a combination of, this is a punt, but you know, yes, a combination of technology, law, and politics, you know, is what we need here. But I'd like to talk to you more about what you have in mind. So,
you'd mentioned this concerted online effort to collate and go through documents. How different do you think that was from sort of the work product of a well-funded law firm? Was it wider ranging? How much more helpful was that? I mean, it's tremendously valuable.
Yeah, that's a good question. Honestly, I think that we could do a whole lot better than a wiki to analyze a trove of documents. And, you know, Document Cloud kind of gets us part of the way, but we honestly should be anticipating, like, you know, the next leak of video and be thinking harder about how to, you know, collaborate and make sense of that. As far as how it compared to how a law firm would have gone through it, it's hard to say. It was a smaller trove of documents, you know, at the time. There was a fair amount in there. I do know that the documentary filmmaker who I spoke to about it, you know, really got a lot out of, you know, the detail and was using it to follow up on a lot of leads, which I think would be a different intent than a law firm would bring to bear on those documents. But I'd be curious about your ideas on that if you want to talk offline as well.
Cool. You know, I think it's a really interesting talk that you've been giving, and I think a lot about like getting to the root cause of some of these problems, right? So I don't know if you have any thoughts on what individuals and communities can do to address mental health just on a really deep level, right? Like, we've seen really cool stuff come out of the MAPS organization for treating soldiers with PTSD or end-stage cancer patients just racked with trauma, you know, with psychedelics or some kind of nature therapy. So I don't know if you have any thoughts, you know, on what people can do just to try to circumvent this entirely for their own mental health?
Yeah, well, that's a really rich question, and I think each of the thirds of this talk could have been a talk of its own. You know, I went through it really quickly, but a central mantra of the Icarus Project is that friends make the best medicine, and there's an incredible amount of effort to trying to find, you know, help and support within community. And so finding community, creating community, communities like this. They're actually, at Previous Hopes, there was like a long panel on Geeks with Depression, and there was like Blue Geeks, was that the name of it? Was like one of the movements that I know sprung up. I don't know if they stuck. Aaron Swartz, you know, comes to mind as someone who, you know, I think we should look to as, you know, ways to think about how our community, this community, can support people better and recognize like ways in which they need support and, you know, can manage, you know, and come through crisis and all that. So that's the short answer, friends, community, and peers. There are longer, you know, versions on that have a lot to do with, you know, some of the things you mentioned. But again, let's connect.
Cool, thank you.
Thanks.
Hello. So over the last 12 years, I've been having seizures. And after about a year, my doctors were telling me that, you know, oh, it seems these medications don't work, but let's try some other ones. Came to a point that I had tried over 50 different anti-epileptic drugs, and didn't know what else to do and was having more and more seizures. I'd already known that the medicine wasn't working, but from the massive addiction to multiple different medications, I finally agreed after about 5 years of my doctor suggesting to go get brain surgery to do so, which then created things actually worse for me. And it's created more of an addiction to meds that aren't really doing anything and building this kind of catastrophic spiral getting stuck into with mental health problems. And I've been realizing more and more how not relying on doctors is actually more aiding. And like you said before, having friends to talk to and ways around it like that. I'm dealing with a disability now, trying to just fund life in general. And I just feel pharmaceuticals are not like a truthful thing to believe in that can aid you. And there should be other ways to go around things than pharmaceuticals. So I just want to say I agree with you much on this, and people need to find other directions to help others.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear about your suffering, for sure, and thanks for sharing. One thing real quick, and I want to make sure we have time for this last question, but I do want to make clear that I'm not against data. And when I hear stories like that, it often makes me, you know, realize how important it is for us to start doing a better job of tracking our own health and, you know, all the variables in our own lives, from sleep and nutrition to whatever substances, you know, we're ingesting, and try to correlate and make sense of them. You know, like, I mean, the question, yeah, of who's doing the remembering of this data is really essential, and there's probably a lot to do with that. So, yeah, did you have a question?
Yeah, so good segue with what you just said, but I was wondering if you had thoughts about Australia's effort to create a public health record for every individual that's not opt-in.
So I am not too familiar with what's going on in Australia in detail. I have heard of... In Switzerland, I think, or it was Sweden, I got mixed up. There's a health cooperative where folks are pooling, you know, their own health data and deciding as a community who they want to share it with or not. In other words, like, there is this whole, you know, effort around citizen science, and there does seem to be valuable insights that can be gleaned, you know, from individuals and especially communities that are actually engaging in some of these alternative practices, you know, possibly in ways that pharma will never fund. At the same time, you know, the threat of electronic health systems and the way they're playing out here, I've been in meetings where, you know, the data really flows in one direction and it's happening in slow motion, but it's going to happen. Like, you're, you know, people will be notified of your life events, you know, when you end up in prison, when you die, and the people are going to be on this list, and you may not even get a copy of this. And it's like, you know, there's this zombie that seems to be advancing, you know, slowly, but like within 5-7 years, it's going to be in place. And there are, you know, a lot of steps underway here. So again, like, I don't know much about Australia, though I don't know if it's any better here. So maybe you have any more to share on that. But yeah. Excellent. I think Chelsea is coming up soon, so thank you all for your attention and sticking around, and have a great day.